We'll read verses 1 through 24. Gospel of John, chapter 4, verses 1 through 24. Let us hear God's word. When therefore the Lord knew how the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, though Jesus himself baptized not, but his disciples, he left Judea and departed again into Galilee, and he must needs go through Samaria. Then cometh he to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near to the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied with his journey, sat thus on the well, and it was about the sixth hour. There cometh a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus saith unto her, Give me to drink, for his disciples were gone away unto the city to buy meat. Then saith the woman of Samaria unto him, How is it that thou, being a Jew, askest drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. Jesus answered and said unto her, If thou knewest the gift of God, and who it is that saith to thee, Give me to drink, thou wouldest have asked of him, and he would have given thee living water. The woman saith unto him, Sir, thou hast nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. From whence then hast thou that living water? Art thou greater than our father Jacob, which gave us the well, and drank thereof himself and his children and his cattle? Jesus answered and said unto her, Whosoever drinketh of this water shall thirst again. But whosoever drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst. But the water that I shall give him shall be a well in him, a well of water springing up to everlasting life. The woman saith unto him, Sir, give me this water that I thirst not, neither come hither to draw. Jesus saith unto her, Go, call thy husband and come hither. The woman answered and said, I have no husband. Jesus said unto her, Thou hast well said, I have no husband, for thou hast had five husbands, and he whom thou now hast is not thy husband. In that saidest thou truly. The woman saith unto him, Sir, I perceive that thou art a prophet. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Jesus saith unto her, Woman, believe me, the hour cometh when ye shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. Ye worship ye know not what. We worship, or we know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshippers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. Thus ends the reading of God's holy and inspired word. Now this Lord's Day evening, we come to look at the third message in a series of messages on the doctrine of God. And as we begin this study, I want us to think briefly of the blessings that God promises to bestow upon the people of God that are returning from captivity. The prophet Jeremiah speaks to the people of God that are about to go into captivity, the Babylonian captivity, but he also, in speaking to them and telling them what's about to take place and them being taken to Babylon, he also tells them of the blessing that God will send them as a nation when he causes them to return. And in those blessings that he gives the people of God in returning them to Babylon under Zerubbabel and Ezra and Nehemiah, he gives us a picture of the new covenant blessings that are ours in Christ Jesus. And in Jeremiah 24:7, God speaks to them through Jeremiah and thus to us. He says this, he says, I will give them an heart to know me, that I am the Lord, and they shall be mine, and I will be their God. For they shall return unto me with their whole heart. You see, God says He will give them, He will give His people a heart to know Him. You see, we need more than just an intellect to know God. We need a heart. And we need a heart that God gives us. Our own hearts won't do. Only hearts regenerated by the power of God can truly know God. He'll give us a heart to know Him, that I am the Lord. You see that, children, in Jeremiah 24:7, the word Lord there has all four letters capitalized. It's that word that we looked at last Lord's Day evening, Yahweh. God is saying, I am Yahweh. I am the God that always is and always has been and always will be the same. They'll understand me. And that name encompasses all that God is. But notice he goes on and says, and they shall be mine, and I will be their God. When a person knows God, they have an intimate relationship with God. It's not just a knowledge that's just intellectual. It's a knowledge that's personal. And remember, we looked at that two Lord's Day evenings ago, and we looked at what it meant to know God. That knowledge in the Bible is an intimate relationship. We will be His, and He will be ours. And He will cause us, as His people, to return to Him with our whole heart. That's what it means to know God. To turn to Him with all of our being, with all that we are in our souls, with the whole image of God, all the faculties that He's given us of intellect, of will, of emotion, of conscience, all these faculties that God has given us, we give back to Him in totality. Now, two Lord's Day evenings ago, we looked at the knowability and incomprehensibility of God. We saw that God is indeed knowable and that we ought to glory in our knowledge of God. That our knowledge of God ought to be what we glory in. All that we care about. And God spoke to His people. Again, the people that were about to go into the captivity in Jeremiah 9. And He tells them that they're not to glory in their riches, they're not to glory in their power, they're not to glory in their wisdom, but they're to glory in the knowledge of God. And last Lord's Day evening, we looked at God's name, that predominant name that He's known in the Old Testament, of Yahweh. And we saw that in that name, God declares Himself to be independent, that no one can control God. That God controls everything and nothing controls Him. And also we saw that God is indivisible, that He can't be separated, that He's not made up of parts, but He's a complete whole. He declared to Moses, I am that I am. And in that word, in those words, He's explaining that name that He's given to the people of God to call Him Yahweh or Lord. So we see that God declares Himself to us. He reveals Himself to us. We've seen Him reveal Himself to the people of the captivity through Jeremiah. We've seen Him reveal Himself to Moses in the burning bush. And now this evening we're going to see God the Son revealing Himself to a Samaritan woman at Jacob's well. God reveals Himself to people. The great I Am reveals Himself. What's very interesting is that Jesus Christ Himself claims to be Yahweh. In John 8:58, He says of Himself to the Pharisees, verily, verily. And children, those words in the Greek are Amen. 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 So it be. I say unto you, before Abraham was, I am. Jesus is telling them that He is the great Jehovah. That He is the second person of the Trinity. But now He declares Himself and declares something of the character of God here in John 4 to this Samaritan woman. Let us understand the context first. Jesus is leaving. He's going to Galilee from Judea. And it says in verse 4, and He must needs go through Samaria. He didn't have to go through Samaria to get to Galilee from Judea. It wasn't the shortest way from Judea to Galilee. But He had a reason, He had a purpose for going there. And the rest of this chapter tells us exactly what that purpose was. He arrives at the sixth hour, which is noon in the Jewish time. And He's thirsty. It says He's wearied in verse 6. You see, though Jesus was God, He was still man. And His body did grow weary. He was thirsty. And a woman comes to the well, and He asks her for a drink. And she asks Him, why are you asking me? Jews don't talk to Samaritans. They don't have any dealings with us. Why are you talking to me? And Jesus takes that opportunity to publish to her the gospel in a figure of living water. Now obviously, she doesn't understand. She asks Him, how are you going to get this living water? The well's deep, you don't have anywhere to draw with. She asks Him, are thou greater than our father Jacob, which gave us the well? She doesn't understand who He is. She doesn't think Him to be greater than Jacob. So He seeks again to explain this living water. But she still fails to grasp it. She says, sir, give me this water that I thirst not, neither come hither to draw. She thinks that if He gives her the living water, that she's never going to need to drink any water again all of her life. She fails to see that the picture He's setting of this living water is spiritual. That this living water does not cure our physical thirst. You see, she's still without spiritual perception. So then, He seeks to convict her of her sin in verses 16 through 18. Jesus says unto her, go, call thy husband and come hither. And the woman answered and said, I have no husband. Jesus said unto her, thou hast well said, I have no husband, for thou hast had five husbands, and he whom thou now hast is not thy husband. And that saidest thou truly. You see, He's convicting her of her sin, of adultery. But then in verse 19, she answers back. The woman saith unto him, sir, I perceive that thou art a prophet. Instead of being very convicted about her sin, now she sees this man as now a little bit better maybe than Jacob, certainly more than she thought him to be at first. Now he's a prophet, he knows her past. But she still fails to see that Jesus Himself is God. Then she asks Him a question, perceiving Him to be a prophet. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. It seems like she's diverting Him from attention on her sin. Now she wants a theological question answered. Instead of dealing with her sin, she wants to know where's the right place to worship. So Jesus says in verse 21, woman, believe me, the hour cometh when ye shall neither in this mountain nor yet in Jerusalem worship the Father. What Jesus is saying is that there's a new state a new condition about to take place in which worship in either place will be unnecessary, where worship can take place anywhere, where worship will transcend a given geographic location. He says that new state is near at hand. But then, he corrects her in verse 22. And many, I think today, misunderstand what Jesus is saying because they fail to see in verse 22 this reproof that he's bringing. He says, "Ye worship, ye know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews." What he's saying is, up till this point, it's been right to worship in Jerusalem because that's where God has declared that worship is to take place. And we worship a God that we know, a God that's revealed Himself to us, not a God that's a figment of our imaginations. We haven't made up our religion. We're worshiping the God who has revealed Himself to us, and we're doing so according to His will. Of course, not perfectly. The Jews weren't flawless. But he says, salvation is of the Jews. God was pleased to declare Himself to the Jews. And the Samaritans, if they wanted to worship the true God, they should have aligned themselves with the Jews. They should have became proselytes and worshiped God according to His word. But then he goes on to say in verse 23, and he returns to the same theme that he was speaking of in 21. But the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshippers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father seeketh such to worship Him. He says, now a time's coming when worship is going to not only deal with our knowledge of God and truth, but it's also now going to transcend externals and a geographic location. Now we're going to worship in spirit and in truth. We're going to worship the Father, it says, in spirit and truth. Then it says, the Father seeketh such to worship Him. You see, when God does a work in a person's life and brings him or her to Christ, He makes that person a worshiper. Every true believer is a true worshiper. You see, you can't be a Christian and not worship God. It's impossible to do so. Because God seeketh such to worship Him. But notice in verse 23 how it speaks of the Father, and then in verse 24 it doesn't speak of the Father any longer, it speaks of God. God, it doesn't say the Father is a spirit, it says God is a spirit, and they that worship Him must worship Him in spirit and in truth. And this is the text for this evening. God is a spirit, and they that worship Him must worship Him in spirit and in truth. I want us this evening to look at just the phrase, God is a spirit. And then, Lord willing, two Lord's Day evenings from now, we'll look at the second part of the verse. And they that worship Him must worship Him in spirit and in truth. No option. They must do it. Let us look at the doctrine, God is a spirit, this Lord's Day evening. And two Lord's Day evenings from now, let us look at the duty. And they that worship Him must worship Him in spirit and in truth. Jesus Christ says to the woman in Samaria and to us through His Word, through the Apostle John, God is a spirit. It literally reads in the Greek, a spirit is God. But in Greek, the subject and the object are always in different places. So, God is a spirit is accurate. But it probably would be better to translate God is spirit. No pronoun. God is spirit. You see, what John is saying, what Jesus is saying here, is not that God is one spirit among many, though there is a sense that He is. But what Jesus is saying is God is the supreme spirit. He's the eternal, originating spirit of all spirits that exist. Children, do you understand what it is to be a spirit? Do you understand what a spirit is? It's hard to understand what a spirit is because a spirit is beyond the reach of our senses. We can't see, touch, taste a spirit, can we? Jesus, in His resurrected body, says to His disciples, they think He's a spirit, and He says to them, "Behold my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Handle me and see, for a spirit hath not flesh and bones, as ye see me have." You see, Jesus in His resurrected body is not a spirit. Now, a resurrected body has some attributes like a spirit, but Jesus is not a spirit at the right hand of God the Father. He is in a body, a resurrected body. But He tells the disciples that they can touch Him, they can see Him. And He says, "See, because you can see me and you can touch me, I'm not a spirit. Because a spirit you can't see or touch. You can't handle a spirit." Now, can you all think of some things that are spirits today? God says that angels are spirits. In Psalm 104:4, we read, "Of God who maketh His angels spirits, His ministers of flaming fire." You see, God created spirits, angels. So unfallen angels are spirits, but so are fallen angels spirits. In Mark 1:27, we read, "For with authority commandeth He," that's Christ, "commandeth He even the unclean spirits, and they obey Him." So there are fallen angels and unfallen angels that are spirits. But did you realize that all men, women, and children that are alive have a spirit or a soul within them? Think of Ecclesiastes 12:7. There we read, "Then shall the dust return to the earth as it was." Speaking of death. "Then shall the dust return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return unto God who gave it." You see, when a man or a woman or a child dies, they go right to the judgment of their soul. They go right to God and they're judged in their spirits. So there are created spirits, and yet the Apostle Paul says in Hebrews 12:7 of God that He is the Father of spirits. You see, God has created spirits, but He is the Father of spirits. He is the originating spirit. He's the eternal spirit. Now, in Romans 1:4 and in Hebrews 9:14, we learn about Christ Himself, in one sense, being a spirit. Because in His very essence as God, He is well, His spirit. You see, Jesus didn't always have a body, children. He took on flesh, but He's not eternally flesh. That's not of His essence. Now, James Fisher, the Scottish Presbyterian, in his commentary on the Shorter Catechism, in particular on question 4, asks this question: why is He said to be a spirit? And the answer is, Because God is necessary and essentially a living, intelligent substance, incorruptible, incorporeal, without flesh or bones or bodily parts. Some big words there, aren't there, children? But I want us to see two things in particular. That God is a living, intelligent being. And secondly, that He is without flesh or bones or bodily parts. God is personal, and God is incorporeal, which that's a big word, but maybe an easier word for you children to remember is God is invisible. God is personal, and God is invisible. God exists. He is a being. He's self-conscious. He can think about Himself. He's living, and He's active. Do you remember the answer to the shorter catechism question number 4, children? What is God? In it, the answer is, God is a spirit, infinite, eternal, and unchangeable in His being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth. But did you notice that one word I emphasized? His? God is personal. And the implication of God being personal is that personal creatures like us and like angels can have communion with Him. You see, because He's personal, He can have a relationship with us. So it's important for us to understand that God is a person. Or really, it would be better to say God is personal. Because there are three persons in the Godhead. It's not the most accurate for us to say God is a person, is it? Because God is three persons, but God is personal. And so the fact that God is a spirit and He's personal is at the very root of what true religion is all about. What is true religion other than the knowledge of God? And what else is the knowledge of God but communion with God? And communion with God can only take place because God is personal. He's made Himself known to us. And He's made us as persons, as personal, because we're made in His image, because we have a spirit. Children, if you were to see a dead man on the highway driving home, let's say a man's been in an accident, he's dead. You pull up, your daddy tries to help, he's dead. Does he have a spirit in him any longer? Is he living? If his spirit is gone, he's no longer alive. That body is no longer a person, is it, in that sense? You see, but when God places a spirit in a body, then that person can have communion with Him. You see, a body by itself can't have communion with God. A body with a spirit in it can have communion with God, and a spirit can have communion with God, but a body by itself cannot have communion with God. Because a body without a spirit cannot have a relationship with the personal God. You see, the body just returns to dust. It's just made up of many atoms, many molecules, of various chemicals. But none of those chemicals can have a relationship with God without a spirit. So God is personal. But secondly, God is incorporeal. It's a big word. But what it means is God doesn't have a body. Paul says in Acts 17:29, as he preaches to the heathen, he says, "For as much as we are the offspring of God," in other words, because we're created by God, "we ought not to think that the Godhead is like unto gold or silver or stone, graven by art and man's device." Because we've been created by God, we ought to know that we're more than just physical beings. Aren't we smart enough to realize that the one who's created us is not physical, that we can't develop his image out of gold or silver or art? The Children's Catechism says this of God, he doesn't have a body like men. And that's a very good answer. It's a very good way to understand it. God doesn't have a body like us. Now we might ask, how come the Bible quite often ascribes to God particular body parts? It speaks of God's arm, of God's hands, of God's eye, doesn't it? I think we've talked about this before, but we have to remember the answer is that God speaks to us in language that we understand. So he describes himself as having eyes, as having an arm. He describes himself as having eyes because he sees all things. He describes himself as having a right arm of power because he is all powerful and strong. But I think there's also potentially another reason why he ascribes to himself these body parts, and that is that he's foreshadowing the incarnation of the Lord Jesus Christ, of the second person of the Godhead. And therefore we have to understand when we read those passages that are anthropomorphic, that describe God with bodily parts, we have to understand that God is bigger than that. But he's describing himself like that so that we might understand him. Remember what I said about Calvin. Calvin said that God does this, and when he does so, he's speaking baby talk. He's speaking in a way that we might understand him. Because he is infinite in his knowledge, but he's got to condescend to us, his people. So God doesn't have a body like man. Secondly, he's invisible. In John 1:18, we read this, no man hath seen God at any time. No man hath seen God at any time. That's because God can't be seen. That's why no man has seen him, because he can't be seen. Now someone might raise the objection, didn't Jacob and Moses see God? Isn't it said of Jacob and Moses that they both saw God face to face? The Word of God does say that in Genesis and in Deuteronomy regarding Jacob and Moses. But I think we have to understand that when we read that Jacob and Moses saw God face to face, we're to understand that they had a clearer vision, a clearer manifestation of God's presence. Don't we sometimes sense God's presence with us more than others? Don't we ask God to have his countenance shine upon us? And yet, have we ever seen his face? Have we ever seen his countenance shining upon us physically? Of course not. In Exodus 33:20, God says to Moses, this Moses that has supposedly seen God face to face, God says to him, thou canst not see my face, for there shall no man see me and live. So there's a sense that Moses saw God face to face, and yet God says in another sense, nobody can see me face to face in this life. No man on this side of glory can see God face to face. Now certainly on the other side of glory, men can. Remember Jesus' words in Matthew 5:8, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Not that they do see God, they shall. Eventually, in the next life, when their spirits, they'll see God, when they're pure spirits, when they're glorified spirits. In Romans 1:20, Paul says that the invisible things of him, the invisible things of God from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. So what God says is there are invisible things of God that are portrayed that we can see something of because of the created things that he's made. We can understand a little bit of his invisible power and his essence or his Godhead just by what he's made. But he says that these are invisible things. They're things that we can't see. We can't see the essence of God, but we can understand about God by what he's doing, what he's made and what he does. We can better understand his character. In Colossians 1:15, Paul, speaking of Christ, says that he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of every creature. Not that Christ is a creature, but he's the image of the invisible God. You see, God in his essence is invisible, but Jesus in the incarnation is the image of God. So God's invisible. But have you ever thought, and this is complex, children, listen up, that God is invisible in a different way than the angels, than the demons, or than the spirits of men? Created spirits are not absolutely invisible like God is. If you look in the scriptures, can an angel or a demon be in more than one place at one time? They're invisible, but they have a locality. The spirit of man is one place. It's either in the body or it goes to be with God when God chooses to separate the soul from the body. You see, the spirit of men, spirits of fallen angels and unfallen angels, they have a locality, they have a place. They're only at one place at one time. We see that even of Satan, don't we, in Job chapter 1. Job has to go to and fro throughout the earth. He can't see everything that God can see. He may be able to get around pretty quick. He may have an elaborate system of intelligence from all his other fallen angels. But he doesn't know all these things himself immediately. So God is invisible in a different way because no other created spirit is omnipresent, is present everywhere. But God as a spirit is present everywhere. And that's why the Puritan Stephen Charnock could argue, and I won't go into his elaborate arguments, but I think it's worthy to think about and certainly will stretch our minds concerning God's greatness. He says if God were not a spirit, he could not be independent. You see, if God were material, he would be dependent on something or someone else. If God were not a spirit, he could not be indivisible. If God was material, then he could be broken into parts. He could be split up and broken up. If God were not a spirit, he could not be infinite. If God were not a spirit, he could not be eternal. Unless, of course, matter was eternal. But since matter is not, you see, only a spirit can be eternal. If God were not a spirit, he could not be immutable. You see, if God were matter, if God was matter, he could be changed. He could be altered. But God is a spirit. And that's why, as I thought about what Fisher says here, Fisher says that God is incorruptible and incorporeal without flesh or bones or bodily parts. One of the reasons God's incorruptible, do you understand what it means to be incorruptible, children? God can't be corrupted. He can't be weakened or polluted or weakened. He doesn't grow weaker as the years go by. And the reason he doesn't is because he's spirit. You see, all flesh withers because of the fall. We all grow weaker, don't we? We're corruptible, but God is incorruptible, Paul says in Romans 1. God is personal, and therefore he's knowable because he's personal. And God is spirit. He's invisible. He doesn't have a body like men, and we're not to comprehend him in that matter. But so often we do. So often we want to make God in our own image. And all we can comprehend is a God that's made in flesh because we're flesh. But God in His essence is not flesh. In closing this evening, I want to apply this in four ways before we look at the major application of this two Lord's Day evenings from now. Clearly, Christ's predominant application of this doctrine that God is a spirit is the necessity of worshiping Him in spirit and in truth. That's the primary application, but I want to give us four secondary applications tonight. If God's a spirit, and He's made us in His image with spirits or souls, do we see the nobility and the excellence of the soul of man? Think of Jesus' words in Matthew 16:26. For what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Do you see the value, the supreme value of a soul? It's worth more than everything in the world. It's worth more than all the visible creation, Jesus says. If you could have everything, own every person and everything that every person owns right now and lose your soul, you made a bad deal, is what Jesus is saying. If you could have your soul or you could have the whole world and you choose the world, everything of the world, how many people will sell it for $1 million? Or 100,000 or a few million? They'll sell their soul. And Jesus says you can't sell your soul for everything in the world. Everything that God's created. As important and as valuable as God's creation is, don't devalue God's creation. It's valuable. But it's not very valuable when you compare it to the creation of souls. Let us understand the nobility and excellence of the soul. Secondly, let us contemplate the necessity of holiness in the soul. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 7:1, having therefore these promises, dearly beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. You see, so often, we only want to take holiness just far enough to the physical. We just want it to be a few do's and a few don'ts in the external. And we think that we've achieved holiness before God. But God is a spirit, and He sees our spirits, and He knows our thoughts, He knows our motives, He knows why we do things. So Paul says our sanctification has to go deeper than just doing a few things and not doing a few things. No matter how long that list of do's and don'ts is, if it's only external, if it's not internal, God is not pleased. Because we are spirits, because our souls are valuable, so we need to sanctify, be involved in purifying ourselves. He says, Paul says to us, let us cleanse ourselves. As though we could do it. Of course, we can't do it in our own strength. Paul knows that. But he doesn't say, sit back and wait, and God will just do it for you. Does he? He says, let us cleanse ourselves by God's strength. But clean up your act, he's saying. Think about your motives. Think about your heart. Think about your thought life. If somebody was exposed to your thought life over the last week, would you not be ashamed? God's seen your thought life for your whole life. Ought we not to be ashamed in His presence of what we spend our time thinking about? We've seen the nobility and excellence of the soul, the necessity of holiness in the soul. Thirdly, we need to learn that we're not to make images of the Godhead. Isn't that God's argument in Deuteronomy 4:15-16 through the words, through the mouth of Moses? He says, "Take ye therefore good heed unto yourselves, for ye saw no manner of similitude on the day that the Lord spake unto you in Horeb out of the midst of the fire, lest ye corrupt yourselves and make you a graven image."